When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today's podcast is presented by Podgo. Podgo is the easiest way for you to monetize your podcast, providing podcasters with a flat rate for ad space so you always know how much you get when you include an ad from Podgo. I recently joined as a member and you can too. Apply today to become a member and immediately be connected with advertisers that fit your audience. That's podgo.co at podgo.co. And remember, to include the name The Scoreless Thriller Podcast in your application. Thank you.
Man there trying to stop Groper getting himself into further trouble.
It's a fucking disgrace.
Oh, it's not a bad ball for Pelle on the right side. It's Carlos Alberto. And what a great goal that was! Carlos Alberto!
Maradona just walked away from Hoddle then. Maldano. Houston.
Met de balbezit voor Frank de Boer. Frank de Boer speelt de bal heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp met de bal aan! Dennis Bergkamp!
Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp!
Oh! Frank de Boer speelt de bal naar Dennis Bergkamp! Die neemt de bal feilloos aan! En hij schiet de bal erin!
Hello and welcome back to another exciting episode of the Scoreless Thriller Podcast. Thank you for joining us again. I'm joined as always by Leon. Leon, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
And do you know why you're doing great?
Because Lucas is joining us today.
We're a special superstar. Lucas is a football knowledge encyclopedia. And he's here to wow us on the podcast.
And former sports journalist.
It's good to have you on the podcast, Lucas. Lucas, what game are we talking about today?
We're talking about the Miracle of Bern, 1954. Germany playing against Hungary.
The magical Magyars. Before we go into the game, I prepared a little bit of a quiz about the 1954 World Cup. Normally on the podcast, we've just had just one question, just a little brain teaser from the era. But because to celebrate Lucas joining on the podcast, we have expanded the quiz. So now we have two rounds of three questions where Leon and Lucas will battle it off.
I'm feeling super self-conscious.
Yeah, for the supreme knowledge on the 1954 World Cup.
Oh, shit.
So we're going to start with question one from round one. Round one is all about qualifying. So all about qualifying for the 1954 World Cup. So question one. Germany qualified for the... So you're both going to answer at the same time, by the way. That's going to be... Like, you're both going to answer the same questions, if that makes sense to you.
At the same time.
No, I mean, not the same time, though. That would be a bit too synchronous. Okay. I would be a little bit put out if you'd both answered at the same time.
Okay, Lucas goes first.
Then it would look like...
Lucas goes first.
Yeah, for question one, Lucas goes first.
Take it away.
Because I would be a bit confused if you both answered at the same time. I feel like you might have cheated and looked at my quiz beforehand if you both answered at the same time beforehand.
Okay.
Do you not think?
Yeah, no, I get it.
Okay.
But this way I can just wait for Lucas to say it and then see what's sensible.
I did just realize a few minutes ago that was a fatal flaw in the quiz.
But
if we switch it around each one, so like Lucas answers first on question one and then you answer first on question two, I think we'll be okay. We will try. I'm sorry, listeners, this is just the first time. There are going to be hiccups, there are going to be problems, but that's just the way it goes on the Scoreless Thriller Podcast. We plow on through them. Anyway, question one. So Germany qualified for the 1954 World Cup by topping a group with Norway and one other team. This other team was bizarrely a current German state. Which state was it?
Current German state, then the People's Republic, DDR?
No. The GDR, you mean?
GDR?
Yeah.
It's my guess.
A current German state.
Current German state.
So was it...
They were playing as a different team to Germany. Like, there was three teams in the group.
Yeah.
Germany, Norway, and this state.
I think I know. Was it in the western part of Germany, formerly?
Okay. Potentially.
See, now I've quite forgotten the name.
Bear in mind, if you say the German name, I might not know what you're saying. But
okay.
But if you say it, I can look it up. So. Just there's not infinite time. That's unfair on Lucas because Lucas okay. answered. Yeah, Lucas was okay. Lucas was serious and answered straight away. We will cut out all the pause and then you'll be like immediately.
Like Elsa St. Lothring, but it was somewhere there, like Saarland.
No, you have to give. You have to, no
eyes. I'll be like Saarland.
So the correct answer was Saarland.
Yes!
Saarland competed in one qualifying for a World Cup, and they finished second in the group. So the final group game was a playoff between Saarland and Germany. Makes sense. But Saarland is, I'm not entirely sure, but you probably know a bit better. It's this the part of the Western Germany which was taken over by the French after the war,
After the war, yes. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have 1-0. 1-0.
How does it feel, Lucas? How does it feel?
Pressure's
rising.
Yeah,
as you're supposed to do, right? It's a quiz, man.
Also, Alex said former German state, so I was a bit confused.
Because it was.
It's like an occupied state.
It became part of Germany like in the 50s. Yeah. Anyway, question two.
Bring it on.
14-year-old Italian boy, Luigi Franco Gemma, had a major role to play in the playoff between Turkey and Spain, which Turkey qualified from. What did he do? A. He was a ball boy, and one of the Spanish players got sent off for kicking the ball at him in anger. B. The Spanish players complained of food poisoning and blamed the boy who delivered their pre-match meal. C. The boy was found hiding in the Turkish team's dressing room amid allegations that the Spanish team had sent him as a spy. D. He was blindfolded and drew the lots, which allowed Turkey to qualify.
He was blindfolded. Yeah.
I'm going for C.
Found hiding in the Turkish team's dressing room. I can reveal the correct answer was D.
Oh, no.
So they played two games, and one of the teams won one game, and the other team won the other. And for some reason, they didn't use aggregate. It was just like two wins.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, I think they drew the third game as well, sorry. So they won both had 1-1, and then the third game was in Italy.
Yeah.
So that was a draw. And then they had this boy who like worked for somebody else in the stadium, blindfold, and then draw the lots for the team to qualify for the World Cup. And then Turkey qualified instead of Spain. Question three. How many Asian teams competed at the tournament?
One, South Korea.
I'll second that. It was one, South Korea. And everyone complained at how bad they were. So, there we go.
The correct answer was South Korea, yes. There's kind of a tactics to this quiz, Lucas. You need to pretend that you didn't know it. Be a bit more, maybe it's two, maybe it's three, and then say one. Because then Leon knew immediately that it was one.
I felt very positive that my answer was correct.
Okay, question one of round two. So this is going to be who guesses closest to the correct answer. There were 26 games at the 1954 World Cup. How many goals were there? Nearest guess wins.
26 matches.
Yeah.
Okay, so average score was like 4.5 goals, I would guess. Was it? Lucas?
Yeah, I was taking the same approach. I'm going for 130 goals.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to go for 125.
So the correct answer was 140, which means Lucas gets the point.
There you go.
So the average number of goals was 5.38 per game.
So I was a bit off.
One of these players did not play for Brazil at the 1954 World Cup. Give me the made-up name. Pinga, Dolinto, Baltazar, Didi. Pinga, Dolinto, Baltazar, Didi.
You have to go first, Lucas.
B,
Dolinto?
Dolinto.
I'm going to go with A.
Pinga. The correct answer was B, Dolinto.
There you go.
The scores are level coming into the last question. According to the FIFA rankings, who was the worst team at the 1954 World Cup? A, Scotland. B, France. C, South Korea. D, Mexico.
I mean, I would have gone for South Korea.
Yeah, then go for something
But for the sake of it, you know, I don't want to
make it more exciting. So we've got what, Mexico, South Korea, France, and
Scotland.
Scotland.
They were competing.
Back
in the days, man, I don't know.
Mm.
Have you heard anything about France at that point in time? France playing the football.
I only heard about the crates.
They can't be rated worse than South Korea, though. Can they?
Alex? Who knows? I'm the one who made the quiz.
Okay. Jeez. Okay. I'm going for Mexico, man. Whatever. Just to make it more interesting.
Yeah. Lucas has come in and he has gone home with the trophy of winning the quiz.
Oh, it was sweet. South Korea.
Oh,
what a comeback!
3-1 down, and he comes back to win 4-3. Any words after your?
Yeah, great relief. I felt embarrassed.
I'm so disappointed, man. But I also feel like.
But I also feel like
I should have just gone for South Korea. Yeah. Like, I hate the question. Can I blame you?
Can
I blame you? I feel like we had two South Korea questions now.
Yeah, that is true. But you kind of answered South Korea earlier in the thing, so then it was like, oh shit, that's the last question.
Yeah.
It's kind of obvious it's going to be South Korea.
Yeah.
But next time we will not have that.
Okay.
We will have a different thing. But thank you for joining us.
Love the effort, though.
Yeah,
congratulations, Lucas. I admire you. I admire you and your knowledge about football and this World Cup. I'm very excited. I'm looking forward to what else you can contribute today. So this has been a very good setup.
It's almost as if he does it for a living, right?
I know. It's impressive, man.
Hello, my name's Danny and welcome to Two Lads Talking, the weekly podcast where we rank a different subject each week from the worst to the best. We have Nate.
Hello.
And we have Zach.
Hello.
Get a brew, chill out tonight and do the sucky penguin.
No.
Oh, it's got really warm.
Me too, I'm going to get my fan out.
Listen to us battle it out with subjects ranging from biscuits to zoo animals.
I love the part of Nelson Mandela.
Where are you from?
Don't know.
Check us out every Thursday on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast.
Yeah, I don't think you understand, Dan. I lost my pants.
Two lads talking. Hang on a minute. There's three of us.
The sort of where the Hungarian team's sort of mythology kind of is copper fastened is when they go to England in 1953. And this kind of myth of British or English football superiority hadn't quite been destroyed yet.
So no, they never lost to a continental European team, right?
Mm,
ever
yeah.
before.
At home. Even though they, like, you think they would have kind of, like, learned their lesson because they got knocked out of the 1950 World Cup by some amateurs from America. So you think, you know, already they should have been a little bit more circumspect.
Yeah.
But so the Hungarian team turns up at Wembley and the British press is like, how will they handle with our, you know, more robust, you know, these flaky sort of Hungarians with their flair and stuff will not be able to handle the physicality and the brilliance of our English boys.
The heat.
So then, it was billed as the match of the century and the Hungarian team turn up and they just wipe the floor with them. They beat, like, just, you know, they're basically playing another sport. So injured England players, Tom Finney, he described it was like cart horses playing race horses. So sort of the robust English whale, like not against these lithe and quick Hungarians with their quick passing and moving them between them and stuff.
Yeah.
This Hungarian team also, they played the first game in Wembley and won 6-3. And then
I love that they went for revenge, right?
Yeah. They didn't learn their lesson. They're like, let's go. I'm sure it was just a once-off. Like, let's go off to Budapest. We'll show actually
what we can do. This was a mistake.
This is the English
let
game.
Let us show what the real English game is all about. We're going to come back for them. We're going to make them suffer. We're going to go to their side of the pond.
And then they go to Budapest and they lose 7-1. So much worse than 6-3.
Utterly annihilated. Yeah.
One of the English players, Sid Owen, he said it was like playing people from outer space. So this Hungarian team had five of probably the best players in the world at the time. So they had Puskas, Higuti, Kosis, Bosic, and Sibor.
Lovely pronunciation.
I mean, beautiful. And then also what was kind of crucial was they had Seba as their coach. And Seba is part of this triangle of Hungarian coaches who are referred to as the coffee house coaches. So they viewed as sort of, they sat in they all loved Vienna and they all loved like to go to Vienna and sort of sit in the coffee house and smoke a cigarette and
sounds so sophisticated.
Discuss how to play football beautifully.
And they had football philosophy.
Yeah, it was like, it was the beginning of sort of viewing football in kind of a way of like art and how like movement and stuff happened and moving, the beginning of the evolution of football tactics. So, and what I also found was one of the right back for Hungary, he, after the game against England, he said it was because of tactics that Hungary won. The match showed the clash of two formations, as often happens, the newer, more developed formation prevailed. So the Hungarians were trying to, I mean, I'm not the best person in the world to go about the football tactics, but basically they had moving, the traditional WM formation was reliant on there being a big target man.
Yeah.
But in Hungary, they didn't have this sort of cart horse, big target man.
The niner,
exactly, that they had in England. So what they did was they dropped the nine a little deeper, and then they basically played as like how you would imagine now, like a number 10 or attacking midfielder, and then they fed the two other forwards.
Yeah.
So as a result of that, they kind of bypassed the need for a big number nine. And so Hidiguti was kind of their striker who dropped deeper to create their passing and their lines and stuff like that to develop.
Yeah, which is an idea that kind of returned to modern in football as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. The parallel is quite strong with, you know, the Spain team, how they played basically without a centre forward and the false nine.
Yeah, and very strong attacking playing.
Brutally, it kind of looks a bit like a 4-2-4 formation, more or less, when they have possession and stuff.
Yeah.
But what I also found interesting, so a contemporary of Seves, the coach of the Hungarian team, was a guy called Béla Gutmann. And Béla Gutmann is famous for being kind of traveling all around the world and coaching in a couple different places. Brought the new formation stuff to Brazil after a bit later on in the 50s.
Yeah.
And he had the saying that the third season is fatal. So we would only ever spend like 2 years at one club, right? So he was like, he would spend like different clubs in Europe, and he eventually went to South America and stuff like this.
Yeah.
But also my other favorite story about him is that when he was when he led Benfica to two European Cups in a row in Portugal, and he was a bit angry that they weren't giving him a pay rise or giving him his bonuses correctly for winning
well deserved
bonuses for winning two European Cups. So he had an argument with them and eventually left. And the myth goes that he put a curse on Benfica that they would never win another European championship and be champions of Europe. And since then, Benfica have been to 8 European finals and lost them all.
Wow. Wow. Some football voodoo at work there.
Yeah.
Very strong. Crazy. Those were the golden ages of Hungarian football.
Mm.
They were, before they joined the World Cup, before they played in the World Cup, they were unbeaten for 4 years.
Yeah, for 4 years.
32 matches.
Olympic champions.
European champions, or the equivalent of that during that time. So very impressive, and everyone was expecting them to win. So a really, really, really strong team at the prime of their strength going into this tournament. And then there was Germany, and I don't know, Lucas, maybe you want to go into it a bit deeper.
I mean, it's hard assessing how strong Germany was back then. I don't know what you guys think of it. I mean, there's some names still being known, like Toni Turek, Ottmar Walter, Fritz Walter for sure, Max Morlock. The Nuremberg Stadium is named after him, or was named for a long time. So Helmut Rahn surely is quite known. But it's hard to assess their strengths. They were semi-professionals, if I'm correct. So they were working. They had to take vacation, I remember. So they weren't practicing at all so much. So Hungary was definitely the favorite in my opinion.
And also they were very much also like an unknown quantity, exactly, because it was the first tournament that they had been allowed to compete in after the Second World War.
Yeah.
And it was actually, there was the first time that the German national anthem was played again after the Second World War.
Yeah, so it was the big unknown for this tournament, one might argue, yeah.
And I mean, it's hard to dig in deep on the question how good the Germans were. I mean, you Google them, you look them up, you see little footage. There's little footage left of them playing.
There's even little footage of the match.
Yeah, listeners.
I mean, it's just hard to assess them.
We rewatched the final, but it was kind of, it's very difficult to actually judge too much from the game, just the lack of camera angles, but also the game would regularly stop to display some beautiful sort of photography of the ground.
It was a different vibe, right? It was a bit more artsy, I felt. because you had like some scenes and then you had some pictures.
Yeah.
And it was like more calm, more relaxing.
And a lot of crowd shots. Yeah. A lot of very regular crowd shots.
Like going today.
Yeah. So that was kind of weird. So this tournament begins and Hungary is sort of sweeping everyone before them. And they also play Germany during the group stage as well, and they beat them 8-3 during that.
Yeah, and I think it's very interesting what we talked about just before, because we said they were kind of the big unknown, right, the German team. Mm-hmm. And so what the German coach did in the match against Hungary was playing with the weaker side of his team, so mm-hmm. having a lot of B-level players on the pitch. And so even though Hungary beat Germany 8-3, it was still not 100% sure whether this was actually
the German,
mirroring the strength of the German team, or whether it was just something that was due to the selection of players that were on the pitch. So, yeah.
Yeah, and actually, so during this tournament, Hungary scored 27 goals, which is the record which still stands today. So it's the highest number of goals scored by a team. Yeah. We also have the highest number of goals scored per average per game. Well-known Achilles heel of the Hungarian team was that their defense was weaker, and that fell into the philosophy of the coaches and stuff, that like, doesn't matter how many we concede, we'll always score more.
Yeah, this romantic idea of football that we talked about in this podcast a couple of times before, right? As long as you score more than you get, you will win a match. Like, that's the math.
Yeah, there's a story not the Hungarian coach, but Gutmann again, that when he was managing in...
You're so in love, man.
Gutmann is my hero.
The way you smile when you talk about... Like, the spark in your eyes. I just love it.
No, but I just love... He was very much like an individualist as well, which is a big contrast to Sebes, the Hungarian coach, who was a committed socialist. But Gutmann was sort of like a gun for hire, who would just like travel the world and... Doesn't matter. He wouldn't really care who he fell out with. He'd win things very quickly. It's this crazy story of when he took over Benfica, he fired almost 20 players of the squad and then won the league with youth players.
That's impressive, man.
Yeah. So when he was in when he was managing in Hungary, his team was losing quite badly.
Yeah.
And he was shouting at the right back because the right back was going out and kicking people and playing aggressively. And Gutmann was, insisting that football should be played the right way. So at halftime, he aggressively told the right back, like, you're not allowed to go back out there. And that would have left them with 10 players because obviously substitutions weren't introduced into the game yet. Yeah. But so he instructed the player not to go back out there. But Puskas, who was the captain, told the defender to stay on. And then so the player stayed on. And then in anger that the player stayed on, Gutmann went into the stands and just started reading a racing paper.
Nice.
And just like making clearly his displeasure with the thing. And then he took a tram home without the team. And then he never returned to manage the team.
What? I love it. So principled, this man.
Yeah.
So principled.
Such a,
strong character. Mm. Very steadfast. Yeah.
Yeah. So we should talk a bit about the final now. So the game is, Hungary are very, very strong favourites. They race into a 2-0 lead through two kind of odd goals, right? They're not, there's one shot which is deflected. The second goal by the goalkeeper
hilarious. He's just crawling around in the penalty box, man. I've got no idea what he's
like,
doing.
It's like he's dropped some like pennies or coins on the floor and he's like scrambling around the floor.
His mind is definitely somewhere else, man. I don't know where.
And he tries,
I don't know whether he's on drugs.
Yeah.
We'll discuss this later.
But he tries to get at the ball and he like messes with it and then it falls for the Hungarian player for Zibo. And he scores and makes it 2-0. But West Germany come back very quickly. They score
rather quickly, They gather their strength and their motivation. And I think it's 2 minutes.
Yeah, so the goals come the 6th minute for Hungary for the first one through Puskas. And then Sibor in the 8th minute. And then Morlock makes it 2-1 to Hungary after 10 minutes.
After kind of a weird cross, right?
Yeah, it's a low cross, not very, not smashed. Goes through and he puts it in. And then... They make it 2-2 from a corner.
Yeah.
Zoran.
Yeah.
18th minute.
Yeah. Zoran really stepped up, man. All through the tournament. Like, he wasn't even, I think, part of the major team at the beginning. But then he made
he took a stance for himself, and then in this final he definitely showed why it was worth picking him, man.
I mean, yeah, the Hungarian goalkeeper isn't looking so good.
Yeah.
He kind of runs beneath the ball.
Yeah,
he
tries, he like sort of flaps, sort of misses it, and then it's 2-2. But even like from the match footage that we were able to see, Hungary are sort of very much on top. Like, they have a couple of chances where the goalkeeper makes a good save, and also they hit the post. And I mean, they're kind of on top for most of the game, I feel.
Yeah, they're powering through, man. They're doing what they have to do, but still they're not scoring, so it's an open match when it goes into the second half.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so with 6 minutes to go then, Rahn scores again for West Germany, right? He puts them in the lead.
This is the line of commentary that everyone knows. Every football fan in Germany knows, right?
Yeah, we know it.
That Rahn, im Hintergrund, Rahn müsste schießen, Rahn schießt, Tor, and then he just goes bonkers.
Yeah, there's so many in the final.
You should know, or you heard of, like, at the end of the game, and yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, naming Toni Turek a Teufelskerl, like an amazing guy, and yeah, those ones are really famous.
Yeah, the second thing you just talked about is like a couple of minutes later, where it's just like, the game is over,
aus.
Das Spiel ist aus, Deutschland ist Weltmeister.
Mm. Yeah, so the West Germany take the lead, and then there's still time for...
yeah, let's rewind a bit.
Hungary.
Getting ahead of ourselves.
Hungary almost, like, they think they've equalized. Puskás has scored, and he's, like, celebrating.
To be honest, though, there's no way of knowing.
Yeah, nowadays. I mean, it's impossible to
know. It was called offside.
It was called... This goal, which they thought it leveled it with 2 minutes to go.
It is a controversial decision until today. I don't even know. We can't see it. You can't see it.
Yeah. From what I read, it's like eyewitness accounts differ. So it's, you know, it's kind of impossible.
Which sounds very plausible.
Yeah, I mean...
when do eyewitness accounts do not differ?
Yeah, exactly.
When
in
you
this
watch
situation.
Football.
But yeah, so... West Germany hang on then for the win. And
I mean, you have to imagine this, right? This was post-war Germany, and it was the first time that they got to participate in an international football event again. And then their team, which was kind of an underdog, actually goes through and wins this. So
yeah,
this is huge.
It's kind of interesting. I wonder, like, how happy were people to kind of express sort of patriotic prize in the situation, you know, because it's so soon after the end of World War II, and you know, like, this is the first time Germany's been represented again on the international stage. How happy were people to kind of express their patriotic?
Yeah, it's hard to tell, but I mean, we talked about it earlier already. The first strophe verse of the German anthem, which is forbidden, was sung right in the stadium. That's what I remember. And so, yeah, I guess there were some nationalist undertones, linked to the victory. I mean...
Mm. But I've read it's been, like, very much viewed as a turning point, right? You know,
no, it was. I mean, some even argue that this was the true birth of the new German nation, because there was some kind of national feeling rising again.
Mm.
That we could manage something, even if it's just some sports event that we win, that we can manage as a... at least unified Western Germany country. So yeah, it was very important, I think.
But it's also very interesting because, I mean, I remember in 2006, there was lots of commentary on how Germans were actually happy to display their flag again, right? You know, and that's like 50 years later after this, you know?
Yeah.
So whether how different it was back then to that, or how you kind of quantify how people felt about it.
To be honest, though, I don't know. Because, I mean, the only thing that I actually have to assess this is, like, the one movie everyone watched in Germany, Das Wunder von Bern, where it was portrayed as something that was really important, but that was not, like, majorly patriotic, but just showing that Germany as an entity does still exist and does compete for something. So that was kind of the first idea. And then the idea of showing your flag and everything, that was, I mean, it's still being discussed. It had kind of this revival during the Sommermärchen in Germany, when Germany was hosting the World Cup. But until today, it is controversial.
Yeah.
Especially in more political leftist circles. Yeah. It's not, there's no clear-cut answer to whether it's...
So say if Germany, like, because for instance, if you go to England during the World Cup, everyone will have the flag of St. George outside their window and stuff. When the World Cup is on in Germany, do people do that?
People do it, yeah. They, and there was definitely this drastic increase after the World Cup hosted in Germany, when they people would have it on their cars.
So after the game, it kind of precedes the breakup of this great Hungarian team. So Puskas leaves to play for Real Madrid. It's been viewed also as almost preceding the rising in 56. The team got huge amounts of abuse when they played in Hungary. Puskas was booed wherever he went. The goalkeeper ends up having to be forcibly moved by the regime from Budapest Honved, who was like the biggest winning team in Hungary, and forced to play for this provincial village team. And the authorities start like revoking all the player privileges. You know, they used to have like certain things they were allowed to do, like bring back material objects from the West for their lives and stuff. And it, you know, by 58, I think there's only three or four of this brilliant team who are still playing for the Hungarian team.
Yeah, but because the association between the regime and this football team was so strong before, they were kind of like the pin-up boys for the communist regime in Hungary at that time. So this link was so strong that, of course, afterwards, when they did not manage to win, the regime had to distance themselves in a way. But this immediately sparked protest after the match in Hungary. And a lot of people argue that this is linked to the uprisings that followed.
That's what the goalkeeper Grosic says. He says, in those demonstrations, I believe, lay the seeds of the 1956 uprising.
Yes.
Like I said, Puskas goes plays for Real Madrid and he wins European Cups with them. Sibo and Kosis, they leave and play for Barcelona. Yeah, and at 58, there's only four of them who are still left.
But it's also interesting because nowadays, oftentimes you have this discussion whether sportsmen and women are allowed to show signs of, like, political signs and political symbols. And this oftentimes is not allowed, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's in the Olympics or in FIFA World Cups or whatever. But then, as you see here, there's always this political connotations to sport events. And oftentimes, governments or regimes use these sports events in a very political manner.
Yeah.
So it cannot be detached from this part of the world, right?
No.
Especially big sports events carry heavy political connotations.
And we should also say the demise of the Hungarian team, it's not immediate. You know, even after they lost this final, they play 19 games between 54 and 56. And they win 16 of them.
So in total, you've got 6 years where this Hungarian team loses one match.
Yeah.
Which is the final at the World Cup.
Yeah, and I feel like it's very interesting because we discussed this with our discussing the Brazilian team in 1982.
Yeah.
How these teams who play beautiful football and captured everyone's kind of imagination and are so important for the progression of football.
Yeah.
But on the kind of biggest moment, they just weren't able to get over the line, and whether that sort of adds to the mythology or is a card against them, right? You know, they had, this was the biggest game, and if they had won, I think if that Hungarian team is well remembered, but if that Hungarian team had won a World Cup, how much different things would have been for them as players and people? Maybe they would have stayed in Hungary, things may have changed politically, or what would it have done for football after this?
No, but man, stories are best when they're bittersweet.
I think. Exactly. You know, I think, and it's so interesting also how these tragedies, right, watching this game, the bits that we could see, the parallels between that and the game we watched last week with Brazil and Italy, you know, the beautiful team against the more robust and more
efficient
team. And the thing with the German team with the rain, right, how the rain turned to their favour because they had the Adidas boots.
Yeah.
And what's the phrase for the weather for the player?
Fritz Walter Wetter. We call it in German. If it rains, we will win. That's allegedly what he said. I mean, in the movie, it's depicted like he says it to a Hungarian journalist, as far as I remember. But I don't know if that is accurate. But
it is a term. Like my granddad used to say, right? When we were playing, there was this one goal in his backyard. I was in goal. And I was shooting at goal, he was in goal, and he was always like, this is the Fritz Walter Wetter, we're going to win. So it's something that's out there, it's a slogan, it's a thing.
But we should also briefly touch upon the controversy, which is very...
This is the best issue about it.
This,
right?
Okay.
This is what got me interested in this match again, because before it was always like, it was one win of the German team, which I always deemed to be nice because it's nice to win the World Cup, but it was nothing that closely related to anything I thought about. But then I read this one article which was about drug abused and drugging up players in football history. And then this match came up. So immediately after the match, I think the Hungarian captain says that some of the German players might be on might have been on drugs during the match. And then the story gains momentum, and it has been told and retold up until now. So the question was always whether they had an unfair advantage because they used a specific kind of methamphetamine that was also used during the German wartime. And this was the discussion that was going on, and there are different sides to it. But most of the players on the German team that were still alive, like way back, way later, they always argued that no, we... First, they argued that nothing happened. Then they argued that they only got injected some vitamin C or some glucose. And now the answer that some of the experts might have voiced is what you wanted to look into, right?
Yeah, I mean, I just read the summary of this study. I mean, it's not too telling. It was just, as we said already, mentioning that amphetamine was... used during that time by the national team, and I mean, I looked it up a little bit and I found information on it. I mean, it looks like, yeah, it casts a shadow over the German win, I would say, definitely. So
yeah, but also I think also the point is, would the players have known that they were being injected?
They said that it max was vitamin C that they were given, and only some of them. So that was their point of view, and then yeah, and then the study said that you quoted. I think it's Eric Eggers from the Humboldt University in Berlin. And he said that if you look at the circumstances, and if you look at also the newspaper articles that appeared afterwards, and if you take all this into consideration, then it's highly likely that it was actually Pervitin that was given to these players and not vitamin C, which is the drug that was used during Second World War to pump up the soldiers so that they could go on for days and days and march and fight and whatnot.
But I guess it also falls into, like, doesn't, in some way, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter that they cheated. Like, is there a value in us knowing that they cheated, like, 60-something years later?
Yeah.
Is there a value in knowing that maybe the Hungarian team was cheated out of the World Cup? Because what I also found was, you know, there was no doping protocols introduced until later on in the 60s. So what,
by
nothing,
FIFA, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So officially by FIFA, there was nothing that had to be done about doping at that time. So it wasn't even illegal when it came to competing at the World Cup. But I think within Germany, there were some regulations that did not allow sportsmen to take drugs and dope at that moment in time. But of course, the question is valid. I mean, what does it tell us about it? I feel like the comparison is very strongly to the cycling sport, where nowadays you kind of know that everyone was doping all throughout the time. And now saying that, well, all of these wins were fake, does it do any good? Does it lead anywhere?
Well,
it asks the right questions. I'm totally for calling it out, but yeah, then what do you do with this information? Like, where does it lead you?
Like, unless you can use that information to make anti-doping better in the future, then, you know, what kind of use is it? And like, I think obviously, like, some people obviously were also better at doping, right, than other things. That's the thing with Lance Armstrong. It's not that he was doping. He had, like, the best doping program
but then that's the question.
And bullied everyone out of the game who
tried
to.
But then that's the question. Is this puristic idea of sports that we want, or does it then become more of a duel of mind games and using the right medical applications and enhancements that you can get? And then it might be a completely different competition. And I think it's not this Greek idea of Olympics games where it's just physicality versus physicality, but it's more of like, how far can we take medical advancements to make someone play better? How much difference do you think doping makes in a football match?
I would say surely it does a difference. But I mean, when we talk about professional players, they're all in top shape. There are multiple things being taken into consideration. Like, football is not only about stamina, as we all know. It's about technique. It's about mind.
Argument I just completely think is false, right?
No.
Like, if I can take something which makes me think clearer and in the most crucial moments of football to do my training and my technical training, then that's going to be a massive advantage. What you're kind of saying is the difference between, say, cycling and football is cycling is a pure endurance thing, right? So it's kind of, if I take something, I will be able to breathe for longer and carry on. But I mean, in football, right, if I'm able to run a little bit further than the next person, or if I'm able to, when I'm exhausted and can barely think, take something which will help me to get a little bit further, and that's, you know, that's just as much as an advantage, right?
And it boosts self-confidence, right? Yeah. It's not just about the physicality of it, but it's also about mental aspects. Suddenly you feel like you can do everything. I mean, that's the reason why they gave it to pilots during the Second World War. I mean, it was nothing to do with stamina, maybe also with stamina, but also with focus and being pumped and hyped. Yeah.
And so, no one's saying that, like, to be a pilot doesn't take any skill, right? You need to have some bit of skill or
technical, definitely
experience to be a pilot, but have something which will be able to call on that training at the most crucial time.
But here's the argument, right? These two are the teams that are participating in the final match, right?
Yeah.
So, of course, they have got the technique. Of course, they've got the talent necessary to compete. But then the thing that might just give you the extra edge in the match, that might be the drugs that you take in order to get, you know, kicked.
Yeah, but
or
I wouldn't say in football, I mean, they're all on the same level when it comes to technique.
I mean, talking about modern and football, their players like Messi, Ronaldo, and so, I mean, their first touch is amazing. You can't copy those players. I mean, you can have all the stamina in the world you want, but I mean, if you don't have the technique, if you don't have the shooting skills, like those, the finishing skills those players have, I mean, football is something else.
But there's no drug in the world that I can take and go out tomorrow and play as well as Messi, right? But there is stuff that I can, like, take to help me train and get better, and if I've taken it for a long enough time to keep on training and developing my
Alex
skills
was
to get
like
good.
Looking at us to see whether he could argue that a drug would make him better than us.
But yeah,
but
there
I'm
is.
Glad that he decided not to do it, because that'd be the next controversy that we'd have to talk about.
That we could take the drug and be better than you two and play for Volvox.
Easily. Easily.
Yeah.
I mean, also football is also about tactics, and I mean, it's a complicated game. It's not that simple, you know. It's not just cycling up a hill.
No.
No disrespect to any cyclists, but
disrespect. But serious disrespect.
That's how it is. I mean, there's so many layers to that game, and I mean,
yeah.
There's more complexity.
Yeah, I guess the only thing that I wanted to say is that also when it comes to mental clarity and focus, drugs do help.
I'm not advising anyone to take drugs when they play football.
I'm just saying.
There have been some reports on German football and German amateur football and the misuse of painkillers and so on and so forth.
Also, like the whole East German team, like Olympics teams during the 60s, 70s, and 80s were just.
Okay, but if you knew for sure now that they used Pervitin, would you say that this World Cup win should not be counted?
I have no elaborate opinion on that, but I mean, yeah, the first thought coming to my mind, I would say no. Just no, it's historical.
Just too private.
There's too many, not too broad, but I mean, there are too many grey areas. I mean, we would have to know.
How is this a grey area? I mean, I said that if you knew for sure that they, you know, use drugs in this match.
Yeah,
but I think that's a little bit of a trap, though, right? Because we can't possibly really know for sure.
But this is more of a moral question,
I guess,
than it is of a factual one.
I mean, the grey area I'm referring to is knowing if the Hungarian team has been doped or not. I mean, that's...
Okay, let me give you the answer in our hypothetical world.
No.
Yeah, but it's hypothetical, like you say, and I mean, we should not be guessing... if something happened, and I mean, we can't draw major conclusions.
Yeah, but
it's the basic idea of morals, though, right?
Yeah.
That you build these hypothetical models, and in that world, if that existed, what would be the right thing to do? And I think it's quite interesting. Okay, German team, they used doping, and the Hungarian team did not, and we know this for sure. And this is a World Cup win, right? With a lot of implications.
Yeah.
Should we not say, okay, damn, man, we didn't win this in the way we were supposed to, let's give it to the ones that did?
I mean, if the facts were obvious, I mean, I can agree thinking about it. I mean, it's a difficult question. I can't answer it, like...
On the spot,
Like, spontaneously. I don't know what you guys think about it.
I mean, I think it's impossible to argue otherwise. I think you would have, like, I think you would have to. But I think also, I mean, there's only one German player still left. I feel pretty bad going around to his house and taking his World Cup medal and taking it to, I don't know, there's no Hungarian players still alive, so who do I give it to? Viktor Orban to hang in his...
Would it be different if there were more players, like, still alive? Do you think this is a question of time? So eventually it's just like, it's so far back, it doesn't even matter. Because I mean, if this would be immediately afterwards, right? That would be a different thing.
Yeah,
they
totally.
Just won a week after the team physician says that, yeah, shit, we did something wrong. We gave them drugs. We shouldn't have done this. Then you would argue, I would argue that, yeah, definitely.
No, 100%. I would
to the team of Hungary.
Yeah, no, I would agree. But I think also there is the thing with time now, right? How would you legislate for it, or how would you kind of go around through
okay,
it?
Okay.
It would be a bit of an issue. But it's a very interesting debate. I very enjoyed discussing it with you both today. Thank you for joining us on the podcast. Leon, do you have any final words?
I'm so happy that you joined us today, Lucas. Thank you so much, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
I think what we can... Yeah, maybe my final last words. So I think interesting is that there was no pressing involved back in those games, but still those... The 1954 World Cup, it seemed like the beginning of modern football, in my opinion. I mean, Hungary was playing short pass football, and it was quite progressive. So no pressing involved, but we had the false nine we talked about.
Mm.
And I mean, yeah, lots of talks about tactics and so on and so forth. So for me, 1954 was maybe the beginning of modern football as we know it today. That's what I think about this game.
Yeah, it was fascinating to kind of see it in action. So thank you again for joining us on the podcast. I hope you'll join us again next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Podcast Network.